I'm very well connected to the Shia world, intimately connected. The first thing that everyone needs to know, there's nothing in Palestine that's remotely connected to the Shia. Jerusalem doesn't feature anywhere for the Shia. It has no holiness. Al-Aqsa is a compound, and it has two mosques inside of it. So if you are Shia growing up as a Shia traditionally, these two buildings will not mean anything to you. If anything, you hate them, you hate anyone who constructed them. If you were Shia and you grew up any time until 1979, the odds are Israel was never your enemy. Then Khomeini took it in a different direction. He became very similar to the Sunnis. But in the back mind of the Shia, Jerusalem has no value.
Love, it's great to see you this week. And I guess we weren't sure last episode if we'd have another episode with you. So it's great to have you.
I'm happy to be here. wish that we had better news to share this week, but it seems like everything is starting. Well, it hasn't come to a head yet, but it's getting there on three different fronts for us here in Israel.
Absolutely. And we saw Iran firing on the UAE in an unprovoked manner, or in reaction to actions taken by the United States firing on the UAE.
Yeah, and we have the ceasefire in Lebanon, which never really took hold, but now it's very clear that it's a bit of a dead end. And in Gaza, Hamas refusing to give up its weapons. So we could take a trip around the Middle East now to talk about all of these things. I mean, I guess let's start with Iran. I don't know about you. We're recording on Tuesday, and Iran started shooting at the UAE on Monday night. And I sort of went to sleep thinking, I might be woken up by a siren tonight. And it hasn't happened yet, but I feel like the way things work, right, is Iran shoots at the UAE. They also shot at Oman, from what I understood. The U.S. will respond. And then the way Iran likes to get back at the U.S. is by shooting at Israel. So, like, to me, it feels like it's a matter of time unless something unexpected happens.
Absolutely. And I think people have to understand our calculations, right? I was wondering whether I was going to watch a movie or go to sleep. I'm like, I should go to sleep because I'm probably going to be waking up by the siren from Iran and I'm going to get less sleep. So, you know, these calculations are very practical in terms of how much time you waste before bed. I think what's happening is the U.S. is essentially clearing a pathway through the strait. They've managed to identify a strip of that narrow strait where they know that there aren't Iranian mines, and they can therefore escort ships safely through that area. Iran, it's continuing to be blockaded. On the other hand, it's seeing that the United States is creating that essentially clear pathway through the strait, and it's getting nervous, and that's why it's firing on the UAE. Now, I think we're getting very, very close to the point where the UAE, potentially with other GCC states, responds. I think we're seeing the rhetoric from the UAE, not just defensively, which it's been doing with a great amount of success with Israel's help, but offensively as well. And I think also just we saw what I think is peak Europe in terms of the response. So there was lots of condemnations. Israel, of course, is not just condemning the attacks. Israel is providing the UAE with the Iron Dome, with other anti-drone systems, and has obviously been very vocal in terms of condemning attacks against the UAE. And there was this brilliant tweet by Ursula von der Leyen, the president of EU Commission, and starts off very strong. She says, "Today, our partner, the UAE, was once again the target of a vicious missile and drone attack from Iran." Right? So it's a vicious attack against our partner. And what's the European response? "So we will keep working closely with our partners on de-escalation and diplomatic resolution." Right? That's apparently the very best that the EU can do. And I think more and more people in the UAE and the Gulf are seeing the difference between Israel's response and Europe's response.
I mean, the absurdity is not only that they're saying, okay, let's try diplomacy, but as if the escalation is the UAE's problem. Like, the UAE didn't start this. The UAE didn't want this. Now that it's happened, the UAE says we need to make sure it can't happen again, right? But, like, the UAE didn't start attacking Iran. Like, what do they need to de-escalate? I mean, it's just the whole thing is that the European approach is completely absurd. And I mean, Israel's learning that too, right? Like, Israel is supposedly a partner also of the EU, and yet all the EU ever wants to do is punish it.
I think Foreign Minister Gideon Saar is visiting Germany today. Germany, obviously, still an important ally, and a very important ally of Israel. On the other hand, Germany has been realizing for several years that they need to greatly increase their military capability, due to the threat from Russia, now even more so with President Trump threatening to withdraw NATO troops. But you do get the sense that both in terms of the timeline, they're still talking about a decade or more in terms of building up the German army, and also in terms of the German population. If it's true in Germany, I think it's certainly true in other countries as well, where the population still hasn't made that switch of we need to, and obviously Germany has its history, but we need to expand our military, and we very may well have to, like in Israel, like in other countries, get used to the fact that many more of us will have to actually put our lives on the line in order to defend our homeland.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is beyond our usual scope of discussion, but I think culturally in Europe, a lot of people don't quite look at these places as a homeland or as a, you know, in, or as the nation as something that's sort of worth defending. And that's like, you know, decades of just, I don't want to, maybe indoctrination, but really just a education and a culture that's just stepped away from that. And then you see a lot of resistance to it, right? In these like right-wing political or far-right, however you want to define them, political parties that are rising up in Europe, because there's only so much that you can try to tell people that their identity is bad, right? But I think you're talking about an example where they want people to actually kind of embrace their identities, but only in a certain way. And it creates like a tension and confusion in society. Like the messaging there is inconsistent. So I think it's going to be a challenge for them, for most of Europe, not just Germany.
I agree. The other arena that's heating up is Lebanon, where President Trump called on Prime Minister Netanyahu and Lebanese President Aoun to hold direct talks to meet. Israel signaled that it would be willing to do so. Now we have the Lebanese president and also the Speaker of Parliament and others saying, well, the time is not right for talks. We can't have a talk, so we can't even have a meeting until the fighting stops. But that gives Hezbollah the veto over when talks happen, which is exactly what we wanted to overcome or bypass. Now, anytime Hezbollah launches a rocket, launches a drone, moves its terrorists closer to Israeli troops and forces Israel to respond, well, then that just makes it inappropriate to have talks. And I think this is exactly the problem, where the Lebanese government is once again giving Hezbollah the power to decide when and if talks with Israel happen.
Yeah, I mean, Lebanon has been something akin to a failed state for a really long time now. And part of the reason is that you have a terrorist organization that has them in a chokehold, basically, right? Like it's a terrorist organization that has a country. And it was pleasantly surprising when these negotiations started that Lebanon or some parts of Lebanon were willing to say, no, we want to be freed of that. We want to make our own decisions. And that they were willing to engage directly with Israel and even discuss normalization. But clearly, that didn't last very long. You know, whoever tried it, you know, is now too afraid of what the ramifications might be, that Hezbollah might try to punish them, hurt them, assassinate them, which has happened in Lebanese history, but also to, you know, in other countries that people want to engage with Israel. And so it seems like, you know, we took one step forward and two steps back. I wish it was surprising, but it's not. And at the same time, it's not like this ceasefire ever actually was happening. Hezbollah, they suffered some very, very serious blows from the IDF. But then the IDF sort of unilaterally, because of these talks, scaled things down. But Hezbollah was still attacking the IDF, and the IDF was still responding to that. So it's not like there was ever really a ceasefire.
That's true. And I think that's right. We're seeing that the Lebanese government is unable to, not just not to deliver, but to even take that step of having talks in opposition to Hezbollah's objection. The Lebanese government made a grand announcement they were expelling the Iranian ambassador from Beirut. And I believe that the Iranian ambassador is still there. He was able to stay despite the government's objections. Now, Hezbollah is demanding that the American ambassador be expelled from Beirut. I think that's unlikely, but it definitely shows the balance of power in Beirut with very real consequences for, you know, what happens for the people of Lebanon and also for the people of Israel's north who are still out of their house.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, this is the Lag BaOmer celebrations this week, right? Where marred in part by this whole situation. Usually there's a huge, huge ceremony. Well, maybe usually isn't the right word because there's been all kinds of disruptions for different reasons in the past 6 years or so. But generally, there's a huge celebration on Mount Meron, which is in northern Israel. It's not far from Tzfat, for those who are familiar. And they severely limited it this year because of fear of Hezbollah rockets. And for a lot of religious people in Israel, especially Hasidic people and Sephardic Haredi people, I would say those are like the two big groups that like to go. For them, it's like a big loss of the war. I mean, you can't compare it to people who are experiencing every single day rockets and missiles and things, but it was sort of, I think, a symbolic in a way, right? That this is usually a big gathering of many thousands of people. Now, a lot of people went illegally in the end. It was a few thousand people who broke through police barriers. That's another topic we could discuss. But I felt like that was sort of one of these things that's sort of symbolic about the situation that people in northern Israel are in, where like, most of the country right now feels like, oh, there's no war going on right now, and that they don't necessarily notice or hear about what's going on with people in the north while they're suffering. But then here's a big news story, so people are reminded.
I think in some ways, from the Israeli perspective, there is even more frustration among the Israeli public regarding Lebanon and Hezbollah than with Iran, because it's fairly clear that with Iran, it's kind of out of our hands, right? We're essentially Israel could go back to striking Iran. But at this point, it's clear that everybody's waiting for Trump. And also when Iran attacks, so there's no school, people go down to their safe rooms, but the disruption of daily life is somewhat less. Whereas with Lebanon, where we've been at war since October 8th or October 7th, where there's been ground operations where promises have been made, where there are hundreds of thousands of people who can't safely return to their homes, I think there is a deep frustration that there's a growing frustration that there is no solution on the horizon. And I think that the Miskav Institute had a webinar this week talking about strategically, beyond just tactically, which line do we stop at? What could a solution look like? And there are different ideas. And there are some who also are saying, look, the fact that a British and French colonel 100 years ago, or whenever Sykes-Picot came, drew some lines on a map that have no relation to any logical geography or connection to communities or identities, perhaps, and I know this is maybe an unpopular idea, but those lines drawn on maps by mid-ranking colonial officers 100 years ago based on either colonial interests or just lack of knowledge of the topography or of the communities or of the histories, perhaps those don't have to be sacrosanct. They don't have to be written in stone. Again, whether that means that Israel should stay in southern Lebanon, shouldn't stay in southern Lebanon, I think that remains to be seen. But I think people in Israel certainly are thinking about what could be a more creative or out-of-the-box solution so we can finally bring some kind of resolution, at least until the Lebanese government is able to take control of its country.
And I just think I wouldn't be surprised, and no one should be surprised, if the IDF scales up its operations in Lebanon again, at least back to what it was a little over a month ago. But we should go down, speaking of a place where the IDF may be scaling up operations again.
And also the place, by the way, where borders were drawn by random colonial officers who didn't, just basically saw, okay, there's a road here, let's take a kilometer from that road and make that into a border without necessarily making any sense. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that.
So that's the case in Gaza as well, not just when it's
right.
Lebanon.
That's definitely the case in Gaza as well. Yeah, in Gaza. So while we're recording, as we speak, the head of the Board of Peace, Nikolai Mladenov, is meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to talk about Gaza because Hamas is not willing to disarm. And earlier this week, Netanyahu met with. I have been translating this term as the inner cabinet, the cabinet mitzumtzam, because miniature cabinet or the short cabinet does not sound good in English, which those are sort of like the translations, right?
The kitchen cabinet.
The kitchen, right. Netanyahu, when's the last time he was in the kitchen? Oh, I know, because he recorded that Instagram video this week where he was peeling a hard-boiled egg in the kitchen. But anyway, that's his post-workout protein, a hard-boiled egg, as we all learned. Anyway, so it's a smaller, even smaller than the regular security cabinet, and they had a discussion about where things should go in Gaza, and I don't think we've seen any reporting on the outcome of that discussion other than the fact that he did not testify in his trial the following day. But it's just Hamas has basically said they're not going to hold up their side of the ceasefire. Again, what a surprise. And they're not going to disarm. And they would only disarm, they would only consider disarming in the framework of the establishment of a Palestinian state, which in the actual Trump plan that they agreed to follow back in October is very, very far down the line and would only happen if the Palestinians met certain conditions that they are nowhere near meeting. So there continue to be situations, I mean, far less than before October. Yeah, like we should admit that it's not, this isn't like full-on war in Gaza at all, but there are still all sorts of situations where Hamas terrorists approach the yellow line, which is sort of the line of where Hamas has control versus where Israel has control, and pose a threat to IDF soldiers. And then, of course, the IDF shoots them. So this week, the IDF killed 3 Hamas terrorists, as far as I know. But Israel is basically saying, like, if Hamas doesn't hold up its side of the bargain, if they don't agree to disarm, then why should Israel have a ceasefire and let them just like survive and run in elections and be part of who's running Gaza? Like that's like October 6th thinking, as they say. So I would imagine that Mladenov is somewhat alarmed by that idea that Israel might ask, you know, might return to full-on war or just scale things up in some way. But on the other hand, the status quo is not something Israel's willing to tolerate, I think, anymore.
I think that's absolutely correct. By the way, in the picture that came out of the meeting with Mladenov, so on one side of the table, the side with Netanyahu, there's Michael Eisenberg, who's been on this podcast before. And on the other side is Aryeh Lightstone, who knows is a friend and a former boss, actually, at the Abraham Accords Peace Institute. I think the reality that's becoming entrenched in Gaza is almost a three-state solution, right? So you have the western side of central and northern Gaza is Hamas-istan, fully controlled by Hamas, and Hamas is expending a lot of time and effort in clamping down on any attempts to challenge its rule. Then on the eastern side of northern and central Gaza, you have the IDF, the Yellow Line, the 70 Ridge, and that's basically an area that's more or less clear of Gazan civilians, and the IDF controls that. And then I think what's happening in terms of the Board of Peace activities is in various projects and initiatives and Green Rafah and others, is that's happening primarily in the south, in the Rafah area, which is largely controlled by the IDF. But I think that is where the Board of Peace and the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, I think that's where their primary activity, at least to date, has been. And I think that that's the reality that we may see going forward, at least until Israel takes action to remove Hamas from Western Gaza, which is that you have the Hamas in the West, the IDF in the East, and this Board of Peace, National Committee, other kinds of international initiatives taking place in largely in Southern Gaza.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess, right? When you describe it that way, like it's not such a big area of land. I don't know the exact square mileage of Gaza, but like it's not a lot. It's like, I don't know, 15 miles, 20 miles tops. And to have so many different things happening piecemeal in such a small zone, I mean, you know, we had that once upon a time in Jerusalem as well, but like it just doesn't seem sustainable in the long term. And so we're just going to have to see where things go.
All right, well, stay tuned for Miskaf Mideast Horizons,
the podcast for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the Middle East. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host and Miskaf Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Miskaf Institute Executive Director and a Visiting Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Miskaf Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we try to cut through the headlines and the noise to bring you fresh insights into the most important issues taking place in Israel and the Middle East.
We encourage you to subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideasthorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And please keep sending them. We've gotten some fantastic suggestions from you recently, and that's influenced the topics that we talk about and some of the guests that we've had. You can also sign up for the Miskaf Institute's new daily brief, Israel in 10, all the news from Israel and the Middle East, plus expert insights in just 10 minutes. And you can follow us on social media, and we look forward to hearing from you. This week's guest is Hussein Abdul Hussein, a research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and the author of The Arab Case for Israel. Having grown up in Iraq and Lebanon, Hussein's research spans the full range of Arab affairs, focusing on Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, the Gulf, and much, much more. He began his career as a reporter and then manager at Beirut's The Daily Star. In the United States, he helped set up and manage the congressionally funded satellite station Al-Hura, Iraq, and led the Washington Bureau of the Kuwaiti daily Al-Ra'i. He's also a fellow at London's Chatham House, and his writings have appeared in many outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, and many more. Hussein really is one of the leading figures and scholars on the contemporary Middle East, as well as the history of ideas, particularly around Shia Islam in Iran, in Iraq, and in the broader region. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this timely and wide-ranging conversation with Hussein Abdul Hussein.
Hussein, thank you so much for being here. We've tried to make this happen a few times now, so I'm really glad to have you on the podcast. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about your background, sort of where you come from, where you grew up, and also how you came to be where you are now in the U.S. at the FDD?
Well, hi, Lahav. Thanks for having me on. I come from a family that my dad is from Iraq, from Baghdad. My mom is from Baalbek in Lebanon. And I grew up in both countries, but after second or third grade in elementary school, we left Iraq permanently during the war with Iran. This was during the early 1980s, and we moved to Lebanon, my mom's country. Of course, 1980s in Lebanon, this is when Israel invaded. This is when Hezbollah was being put together. This is the days of the civil war. And I stayed in Lebanon, went to the American University of Beirut, and I landed a job as a reporter and later as a managing editor with the Daily Star, a newspaper in Lebanon at the time. And in 2004, Congress, the U.S. Congress at the time, was putting together or funding an Arabic TV to support the spreading of democracy. This is, you know, during the early days of the Iraq War. And they recruited me and I joined. I came to Washington and I've been here since.
So I think that really gives us a lot of directions to go in. But maybe we can start with Lebanon, because that's obviously in the headlines. And I know you still have some family members there. The government of Lebanon has not been able to disarm Hezbollah for the last 2.5 years, for the last 20 years. Is it a lack of will? Is it a lack of capability? Is there a division between, let's say, the president, President Aoun, and the military? Is it that there are powerful forces that even not necessarily aligned with Iran, but that think that it's a positive thing that Hezbollah is there, that has its arms? Can you explain why we haven't been able to get to any kind of resolution in Lebanon, despite the intensive fighting of the last 2.5 years and the conflict's been going on for decades?
Well, so quickly, Lebanon was a thriving state when the Arabs were fighting Israel as state to state, when it was a symmetric military to military war, whether in 1949 or 1967 or 1973. Lebanon was thriving. What happened is that after 1967, when the Arab armies were defeated, the Arabs switched from military to asymmetric war, which is armed factions like Hamas or the PLO before Hamas or Hezbollah. And these armed factions are not countries. So they are armed and they decide when to fight, how to fight, where to launch attacks. And these were in Jordan and Lebanon. Now, Jordan, I mean, lucky for the Jordanians, Jordan decided, okay, we're a state. We will not allow these armed factions to run our affairs or decide when to go to war with Israel. And they ejected them in 1970. Lebanon, unfortunately, came under enormous pressure from all kinds of Arab capitals, whether it's Riyadh, Cairo, Baghdad, you name it. Everyone forced Lebanon to accept Arafat and his armed factions to operate out of Lebanon and launch attacks on Israel. And it's unfortunate that since then, the Lebanese state has not been able to restore its sovereignty to pre-1969 days when the state was in it. After Arafat was ejected, after Israel ejected Arafat in 1982, Hezbollah inherited the mantle and kept on or maintained an armed faction. After 1990, when the Lebanese war ended, all the militias disbanded. Hezbollah gave itself exception. Assad of Syria gave Hezbollah an exception to make sure that there's always something that would be off for the Lebanese state, because, of course, Assad didn't want to withdraw from Lebanon. So we have an issue of chronic weakness for the Lebanese state facing armed factions and after that facing the capitals of the region. Now, as we speak right now, and I'm sure everyone heard that President Aoun might be coming to the White House to meet President Trump, and also Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu might be at the meeting, and they might meet face to face, even shake hands, which would be unheard of for, you know, the Lebanese and the Israelis. Now, here's the thing. Guess who's holding back the Lebanese, other than Iran, of course. Hezbollah and Iran don't want any kind of direct talks to Israel. Egypt and Saudi Arabia, they're advising the Lebanese not to go as far as peace and shake hands. And it's, look, the Saudis want all the Arabs to align behind them. So the Saudis say, when we sign peace with Israel, everyone does that. And of course, this is leverage for the Saudis. It's not in the interest of Lebanon. But you'd think, you know, I mean, the Egyptians have a peace treaty since 1979 with Israel. And then they advise the Lebanese not to sign peace treaty. So there are all these factors that come in, and the Lebanese state remains weak and unable to take on Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. By the way, in your conversations, I know the FDD, you're in Washington, you're in touch with officials from the administration. Some of your actual fellows have moved to the administration or gone back and forth. Do you think that the administration is aware of this role that Saudi Arabia and Egypt are playing?
I'm not sure they are aware as much. They probably think that the Saudis or the Egyptians can help, or maybe they're not aware of what they're doing. I'm happy that this U.S. administration, number one, has given Lebanon more attention than any administration since the early days of Ronald Reagan. And this is really interesting and impressive, and I'm happy it's happening. Number two, Washington has shown unparalleled understanding of the nuance of Lebanon. You know, Lebanon is a set of all these tiny minor factions and little things happening. And I was surprised when I heard Secretary of State Marco Rubio describe the Lebanese armed forces very accurately. He said there are fighting battalions that are loyal to the state and who are qualified and competent enough to take on Hezbollah and disarm it. But then there are other factions that are corrupt, that are, you know, loyal to Hezbollah. And this is very sharp. You know, I think I'm happy that someone sees Lebanon as it is, not as we imagine it to be, or just dismiss it and say, this is too complicated for us and we're not going to go into it. So Lebanon now has a golden opportunity that the superpower has its attention undivided on you to help you disarm Hezbollah and live at peace with Israel, Syria, Turkey, Iran, everybody else. So grasp it. And if the Lebanese don't grasp it, I'm not sure there'll be another opportunity in the coming future.
Do you think that the sort of balance of leverage is such that they might be able to take this opportunity, because, you know, the U.S. being the superpower as opposed to the Saudis, the Egyptians, Hezbollah itself? Or do you think they're just so used to not playing on that stage that they might miss this opportunity? And I guess if we're already talking about, you know, superpowers and pressures from the world, maybe a second question about France, that suddenly the France always saw itself as some kind of player and was always trying to get involved. And now it seems that they've given up on that. So I guess, what do you see going on there?
So number one, I think, and I want to give credit to the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, because he's gone further than any of his predecessors or any other Lebanese politician or oligarch, tribal chief, you name it. So he is probably the only elected Lebanese official to state on the record that Hezbollah is treasonous and and wages wars on behalf of Iran. And he's the only person on the record who have said that if we sort things out with Israel in terms of a peace treaty, that he'll be happy to meet with Bibi Netanyahu or whoever is the Israeli prime minister. And this is huge. Now, granted, he's saying, I will not do it the way President Trump is asking. President Trump is saying, shake hands now, we figure out what happens later. But the Lebanese president is saying, no, we have to figure out, we have to figure things out, and then we shake hands. But for a Lebanese president to say that we are parting ways with the Arab League and with Saudi Arabia, and that we are ready to shake hands with the Israeli prime minister if there's an agreement, this is huge. So number one, I think this man is doing great. Now, from time to time, he will say the Israeli enemy or the Israeli aggression. After all, he's the president of the state of Lebanon. There are things that he should react to, you know. But by and large, he's gotten his fair share of attacks from me personally. I've written so many criticism of him. Now, on the French role, look, France has not paid a penny to Lebanon in a long time, and the Saudis haven't paid a penny to Lebanon in a long time. But for some reason, they keep on sitting at the table deciding Lebanon's fate. My guess is that they enjoy the spotlight, they enjoy the photo op, but unlike the United States, we have given Lebanon $3 billion over the past decade, and we are sitting at the table. We are the biggest sponsor, we talk to Israel, we talk to the Lebanese, we're trying to put peace together. Now, these guys, the Saudis and the French, they're there, number one, for their own ego. And number two, in the case of the French, which is more dangerous than the ego. So many times, France tried to curry favor with Iran by taking Hezbollah's side in Lebanon. So the French would tell the Iranians, listen, you know, we will not go against Hezbollah, or we will take the side of Hezbollah, whatever Hezbollah policy, whatever policy Hezbollah is trying to push. But keep that in mind for when the time comes and there are no sanctions and you need to give contracts away, we, the French, took your side. The French do this all the time. They did it with Saddam Hussein. They even done it when Bahrain and UAE went to Security Council with a draft resolution like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, saying that Hormuz Strait is an international waterway and should be open, and the Security Council should allow countries to use military force to open it. The French took the side of the Chinese and the Russians and Iran, effectively. Why would France do that? I mean, okay, you don't like Trump, you know, you don't want to open your airspace or, airports to Trump. But if you are about international law, this is as much international law as it can get. So the French here, what they do is that they hedge against the West, and they hope that if the other side survives, then bingo, they've got the contracts, they got the love, they got whatever it is. And this is what they've been doing in Lebanon. And I was thrilled to hear the Israeli ambassador here in Washington after the first meeting with the Lebanese ambassador come out and say, France, stay out of it. And the French had asked to be part of it. And Israel said, no, I think Lebanon to an extent doesn't want it, even though the Lebanese president makes nice or tries to make nice with the French sometimes. But I think without the French, things would be much better.
I think that's a good slogan for international relations in general. Without France, things will be much better. I'd like to take you to another country in the region, which actually has not been in the headlines, but is critically important from the point of view of the United States, from the point of Israel, and that is Iraq. I mean, it has been in the headlines somewhat, but certainly not like Lebanon or like Iran. There's been a new prime minister selected, Ali al-Zaidi, a prominent business person, who was actually selected by the Shia coordination framework. President Trump posted out, congratulating him, saying the U.S. wants to work with him. Is Iraq moving farther from Iran's orbit? Is it stabilizing? Is this new prime minister going to be, are Iraqi Shias looking more inward rather than towards Tehran? What do you think we're going to see in the next few months under this new prime minister that's been selected?
Well, this was the idea for my second book after the first book, but this was the idea about Iraq, that I want to write a book to show that between March of 2003, say, March 1, 2003, when Saddam was still in power, his last weeks in power. And March 1, 2026, if you take these dates and try to draw lines between them, trend patterns, KPIs, you know, all kinds of trend lines, would you say that Iraq is better off or worse off? And my book would prove that Iraq is way better off than it was in 2003. And Iraq is way better off than had it been left alone like we did with Syria, because, you know, the Syrians got a regime change, but it was all them. I mean, we didn't intervene. The world and the United States didn't intervene. So Syria is organic change. It's just spilling of blood on a massive scale until the Assad collapsed, and now they have a new regime. Compare this to Iraq, and I think Iraq is in a much better position. Iraq is the only country other than Lebanon among the Arab bloc that holds regular election. So this is the sixth parliamentary election they've had since the collapse of Saddam Hussein, which is really, I mean, this is something impressive. And what's most important, that in these elections, candidates really gauge public opinion. They really try to figure out what the public opinion wants. And before that, we assumed that the Shia were all pro-Iran. And that's what the militias in Iraq, the pro-Iran militias in Iraq also assumed. In 2021, most of the Shia factions who were pro-Iran pledged allegiance to Khamenei in Iran publicly. And they said that if there's ever conflict between the United States and Iran, we will be taking the side of Iran. And for doing so, they had, I think, 130 seats, 140 seats. They lost 100 seats in overnight. Like, one election came, that's it. 100 seats gone. So this time, this past election, 2025, 4 years later, the Iraqi Shia parties, most of them, many of them who are pro-Iran, learned this lesson. So this time, they are big on saying that in case of war between the United States and Iran, Iraq is neutral. And this is very important, but this was the official position of the Iraqi government and the Shia prime minister. And this was the position of the bloc of all Iraqi parties, which is called the coordination framework. So the coordination framework, which on its membership has at least two militia chiefs, these eight Shia chiefs came together and issued a statement when this war started between the US and Israel on one side and Iran. They came out with a statement saying that Iraq should remain neutral, not take the side of Iran. So this is very telling. So because these Shia parties changed their rhetoric to cater for Iraqi patriotism, they won their seats back. So in 2025 election, the Shia bloc won back its seats. So now they have 175 seats out of 325. Majority is 165. So now they're back in majority. But the majority thing is that you have eight chiefs, even though these guys are a bloc, but each one of these eight chiefs is trying to get himself elected or selected as prime minister. And this is why you saw all the push and pull and, you know, all the haggling until that they failed to find someone. So they did what they've been doing, what they did three times in the past. Whenever there's a, whenever they come to a point when they can't really select one of them, they pick someone who's a no one, someone who you never heard of. And they put him prime minister, hoping that this no one will not threaten their chances of them coming back to the prime minister office, like a seat warmer. Like, they're hoping that this guy will be there. He's a no one. And by the time he's done, these guys can still have their chance. So of the three no ones in the past, all of them, you know, by now, former prime minister Nouri al-Maliki, former prime minister Haider al-Abadi, and former prime minister Mohamed Shia al-Sudani, who is currently the acting prime minister on his way out. These three guys, all three of them, were no ones. And when the Shia bloc selected them, after they became prime minister, they used the premiership to build their leadership, and they eventually won a bloc in parliament. And once they did that, they tried to come back, but then everybody else is trying to block their way back to the premiership, and that's how they pick the no one. And this no one is Ali Zaidi, who, if you look his name up, he has no political statement to his name, whatsoever. He hasn't said anything political. He's a contractor who supplies the Iraqi army with food portions, who supplies the civilians with food portions. This is an old program from the days of Saddam. And of course, you know, you take out some weight, you inflate the price, and you know, this is how business goes. And you give kickbacks to the officials, and lo and behold, he's become a billionaire. And he has a bank, and he uses his bank to launder some money for the RGC officials. I mean, whoever pays. This guy is a wheeler dealer, and he made a fortune out of doing this. And he has no political predisposition or ideology. The only political statement he's put out since he's become prime minister is that he said Iraq must be balanced in the regional fight. So, which is reiterating what the Shia bloc is saying, neutral. We're not taking the side of Iran or America. Well, that's a great question. It depends on how stable Iraq becomes. At this point, Iraq is not really stable. Corruption is really high. And this really, when corruption is high, it repulses investors. When you want to invest, you want no corruption. You want the rule of law. You want to go to a court if something happens to your investment. Iraq is not there yet. And all the money now in Iraq comes mainly from the revenue of their oil export. They're the second or the third biggest oil exporter in the world. And the Iraqi government makes anywhere between 6 and 8 billion a month. So they have every month they have a surplus of $2 billion. So the money is not an issue. They have money, but you know, mismanagement is huge. And when Hormuz was shut down over the month of March, the Iraqi government didn't even have money to pay its staff. So just to give you an idea how the economy is going. But if eventually things start moving in the right direction and you can get the rule of law and you can lower corruption, then maybe that starts attracting investments to Iraq.
So I want to talk to you about your book, The Arab Case for Israel. Can you share with our listeners what is The Arab Case for Israel? And also how it's been received in the Middle East. What kind of responses have you been getting?
Their case of for Israel is the case that I make to capture my journey as someone who grew up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, shouting slogans against Khomeini and against Israel. And then who moved to Lebanon, then started shouting pro-Khomeini against Saddam Hussein, but still against Israel. And this place that where I grew up, and eventually we moved from my mother's hometown, which is Baalbek in East Lebanon in the Bekaa Valley, and we moved to Beirut. And Beirut was the capital city, so I got much more exposure. And when we moved to Beirut, I parted ways with the with my tribe, with where I grew up, with the ideas that I grew up with. And I started endorsing the non-traditional or non-conservative ideas. And of course, when you do that in that part of the world, it means you're moving from the right to the left. Now, on the left, there are all kinds of Marxists, socialists, anarchists, you name it, all these kinds of, you know, pro-revolution forces. Again, my third iteration of, you know, of thinking was also anti-Israel. So nothing changed. But then there was a few turning points, at least two turning points. But one of them was when Israel pulled out of South Lebanon in the year 2000. I was a reporter with the Daily Star at the time. And I drove to the border and I parked my car there. And I stood and at the time, I think now it has changed a bit. At the time, the border was just a flimsy barbed wire. And, you know, you could touch Israel. You could see Israelis on the other side. And I stood there and I watched Israeli families in Metula and all these towns over there in the north, your north, our south in Lebanon, doing the things, you know, mothers driving their children to stuff and men working the field and, you know, some guy driving a tractor, another guy driving something else. This is the first time that I saw Israeli humans. Until then, my experience about Israel and the Israelis was either the F-16 that you see in the sky or some sort of troops, like, you know, during the War of the Mountain in Lebanon. And, you know, I mean, just tangentially, I didn't have any experience with Israeli troops, but I had seen them like somewhere in Beirut or in Mount Lebanon. This was the first time that I saw Israelis as people like us. And this made me so curious that I thought, okay, I need to learn about this country. I need to learn about this culture. And it happened that I had my radio on and my FM could pick up Israeli news stations or Israeli stations and, you know, pop culture, music, whatever. So I became very curious, except that if you live in Lebanon, you have no access to anything Israeli. The only access you have is usually anti-Israel book, Edward Said from Colombia, you know, Finkelstein, Chomsky, Mein Kampf, you know, you can buy it anywhere. But anything that's slightly objective or slightly describes Israel is not available. So I thought, okay, for me to get access to the Israeli stuff, I need to learn Hebrew so that I can listen to the radio and then I can get access. And I found a spot in Beirut where I could park my car and get Reshet Aleph and Reshet Bet at the time on the AM and start deciphering words and, you know, until I could figure out the language. So I started listening to debate and understanding what the Israelis are saying in their native tongue, not the stuff that they want the other people to listen to. And my biggest surprise was that these guys, unlike I was taught, these guys are not really obsessed with killing all the Arabs and taking all the land and establishing greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. You know, all the conspiracy theory that I had learned at the time, all of it was wrong. And after I came to the United States, of course, over here, I had unlimited access to everything Hebrew and Jewish and Israeli and whatnot. And over here, I understood this is a totally different story from the one that I was taught. And this was my turning point. This is where I thought, okay. And the book captures this journey. And I put it out and I say, you guys, whatever happened in the past, whatever injustice has befallen the Arabs and the Palestinians, moving on and seeing Israel as an asset is much more to the Arab interest than trying to wind the clock back to a time when Israel didn't exist. Even if you think, you know, there's an injustice, even if I tell you move on and you say, but there's an injustice, fine, take the injustice. It'll serve your interest much more than going on with this war. And this is the gist of the book, just my personal experience. And then I project it and show the numbers, show the receipts, as we say here in Washington. Look at the Abraham Accords countries and their trade and economy. Look at the Cold Peace countries, Egypt and Jordan, their trade and economy, which is much less than Abraham Accord countries. Then look at Lebanon and Syria, who are still at war, who are miserably behind the others. So you can establish a trend where the more peaceful you get with Israel and with your surrounding, the better your economy thrives and blooms. And this is the idea of the book.
I want to take you in a slightly different direction. You are a Shia Muslim, and you've spoken about that quite a bit. And certainly in Israel, I think in generally in the West as well, there's a tendency to look at Iran as representing Shia Islam. I recently heard a lecture about Shia Islam in the Indian subcontinent and personally was a little bit surprised to learn about the diversity and different approaches to that. Could you explain a little bit about sort of where the current Ayatollah regime, Khomeini, Khamenei, fit into Shia and how the Iranian regime has actually brought in ideas taken from the Muslim Brotherhood or even taken from Marxism, communism, and sort of inserted that into traditional Shia thinking?
The first thing that everyone needs to know, that there's nothing in Palestine that's remotely connected to the Shia. There's not a single Palestinian Shia, traditionally. I mean, if you find someone, they're probably a convert, or someone from these seven villages that were drawn on the Israeli side back in 1923. There are seven villages that were Maronite and Shia. They were drawn on the Palestine side, not on the Lebanon side. Maybe a family or two who are Shia, who are now Israeli citizens. But that's it. There are Palestinians. There are no Palestinians who are Shia. The Shia also have holy spots. So after Mecca and Medina, of course, Mecca is number one for all the Muslims, including the Shia. Medina is the second city. Now, what's the third city? The third city for the Sunnis is Jerusalem. The third city for the Shia is Najaf in South Iraq. Fourth city is Karbala, also in South Iraq. Jerusalem doesn't feature anywhere for the Shia. It has no holiness. Now, another thing about the Shia in Jerusalem, the main two, you know, the Al-Aqsa is a compound and it has two mosques inside of it. One of it was built by the Caliph, the second Caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab. The other one was built by the Umayyad Caliph, Abdul Malik bin Marwan in 691. Both these guys are very hated by the Shia. You know, one of them killed Imam Hussein, one of them took the imamate from Imam Ali. So both these structures are hated by the Shia. So if you are Shia growing up as a Shia traditionally, these two buildings will not mean anything to you. If anything, you hate them, you hate anyone who constructed them. Now, this is where Iran came in and changed direction for the Shia. Khomeini imported his ideology from the Muslim Brotherhood, from Hassan al-Banna. Hassan al-Banna is an Egyptian who started the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1920s. The Muslim Brotherhood basically says that all the systems of government in the world, especially the Western system of government, don't work. They produce degenerate societies. The best alternative or the best system of government is Islam. So we take the Quran, we take Islam, and this is it. This is government. This is human government and secular government. Hassan al-Banna coded this into his works. Now guess who translated these works from Arabic to Farsi? Ali Khamenei, the guy who was just killed on February 28th. Ali Khamenei was the student of Khomeini. So this is when the Shia started getting the idea that Islam must be the government. This contradicts the basic Shia theology. So in Shia theology, without going in depth, there are 12 imams. They start with Imam Ali, the cousin of Prophet Muhammad, and they end with Imam Mahdi, who is a messianic figure. He disappeared in the 9th century, but he didn't die. He's still alive, but we can't see him. That's the thinking. So until he's back, until we are able to see him, we are not allowed to form any government. This is similar to the Jewish messianic idea, that until the Messiah comes, you have to just wait and deal with whatever earthly government is around you. This is the Shia until Khomeini came in the 1950s and 60s. And when Khomeini came, he imported that Islam should be a government. He clashed with all the senior clerics of the Shia leadership in Najaf. They said, this is not us. You are, and they still say that. I mean, if you look up Ali Sistani, if you look up the Marja'iyya of Najaf, the great authority, they tell Khamenei and Khomeini, this is not our religion. You hijack the religion. So Khomeini comes and he makes Shiism into a state, the Islamic Republic. And now, since he imported all of this from the Sunnis, now Jerusalem becomes important, and you know, and Israel becomes a problem, and which was not a problem until Khomeini showed up. If you were Shia and you grew up any time until 1979, the odds are Israel was never your enemy. And this is a main difference. Now, then Khomeini took it in a different direction. He became very similar to the Sunnis. But in the back mind of the Shia, Jerusalem has no value.
Has Iranian influence, though, largely, have they sort of succeeded in imposing their approach, their ideology, their theology on the Shias in the Middle East? Or is there still sort of widespread opposition to this whole idea of rule by the jurists and the whole sort of apparatus and the innovations that the Khomeini came up with?
So the Iraqi Shia, Iraq is the biggest Arab country with a Shia majority. Yeah, probably 50 million Iraqis, maybe half of them are Shia. This is the biggest cluster of Shia in any Arab country. And the Iraqi Shia disagree with Khomeini. I mean, you know, they fought 8 years of war, and the army couldn't have been Sunni only. The army was Shia, definitely, or majority Shia, at least. Sistani still doesn't subscribe to Khomeini or Khamenei. You have four big marja'iyya, four men who are the biggest marja'iyya. All four of them do not subscribe to Khamenei or the supreme leader of Iran. So the Arab Shia are still holding back, and they don't support this, you know, the rule of the jurisprudence invented by Iran. Now, how did the Jerusalem thing or the Palestine or the Israel thing, how did it become important for the Shia intellectuals or the Shia elite? So if you are Shia in India, the odds are now that you are opposed to Israel and that you support the Palestinians. this didn't come from the Shia. This came from Western intellectuals, from Western academia and journalism. You have to keep in mind that intellectuals in Arab countries, in Iran and in many of these countries, they channel Western thinking and ideology more than the West knows. I mean, even socially, look, listen, the basic premise of Khomeini was that he wants an Islamic government to make sure that that Muslims do not do what the degenerate West does. And this is why you see the officials of the Islamic Republic without ties, because ties to them is doing what the degenerate Western officials do. Everything else seems to be okay.
Israelis don't like ties either, to be honest.
Well, so maybe they share this bit of, you know, we want to be different religiously. That, you know, that we were different from the West, so therefore we don't have ties. But even this didn't work. Listen, I'm very well connected to the Shia world, intimately connected. I have cousins who are believers. And these cousins, the way they handle themselves, the way they date, the way they get married, it's very Western. The way he gets a ring, the way he gets down on knee, the way he proposes, all of this is not traditional. All of this comes from Hollywood and America. So the middle class and the elite channel a lot of Columbia and Harvard and Princeton and what they see on Hollywood. This is how you got these Shia in Indonesia or in India saying that, oh, we care about Jerusalem. Well, this comes from the US. This doesn't come from Najaf or Kalwana.
I was just looking up to confirm this, and I remembered this correctly. But, you know, even Edward Said, the supposedly authentic voice of Palestinians, his PhD is in English literature. So,
absolutely. Just a quick word about Edward Said, by the way. He's a very tiny minority. So he's Protestant Christian, which is a tiny minority in the Levant, because the majority in the Levant is either Maronite, Catholic Maronite, or Greek Orthodox. So it's a very tiny minority, Protestant Christian, from a blue-blooded family, so he didn't really mix with the other guys, who was born with a U.S. passport and who spoke English at home, who learned English, Arabic at age 30. So he's as elite can get. And that's why I have a chapter in the book specifically about this. I say the people who call themselves Arab Americans, and as someone who's fathering two kids who are growing up in the United States, I say, listen, we are Arab, but we're not Arab American. We're Americans who are proud of Arab heritage. Arab American is an identity that's neither Arab nor American. It's a, you know, it's its own hybrid thing, like Edward Said.
Hussein, this has been truly fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time. If people want to follow you, people want to get your book, where should they look?
The book is on Amazon. The link is on my X page.
And we'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yes, and he's a great follow. Everyone should follow you on X.
The handle is HAHUSSAIN.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. And of course, you can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideEastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.